Does this mean I go to jail?
Maybe not if you turn state's evidence.
What does that mean, I think?
It means you write a deposition and sign it. You say what role you played in supplying the beach people with drugs.
I carried the drugs from the chief of police to Fat Sam.
Fletch was sitting on the floor cross-legged before his typewriter. You've got to tell us more than that. Tell me everything. I'll write it down and you sign it.
You know everything.
I need to hear it from you.
What are you going to do with the deposition?
I'm going to turn it over to a friend of mine who works in the district attorney's office. We were in the Marines together. He'll know what to do.
I'll get killed. Cummings is a mean son of a bitch.
I'm going to ask for police protection for you.
Police protection? That's funny.
Not the local police, Gummy. I agree, Cummings is a dangerous man.
Who then, the state police?
Probably federal narcotics agents, or the district attorney's office, I don't know. You'll be taken care of. I want you to nail Cummings.
All right.
The light from the dirty windows was white on Gummy's long face.
Cummings was the source of drugs.
All the drugs?
Yes, all.
What is his source?
I don't know. He goes back and forth to Mexico every few weeks. He tells people he's building a house down there or something for when he retires. He brings the drugs back with him. No one questions the chief of police going through customs.
How does customs know he's a police chief?
Oh, hell, have you ever seen his car? I mean his own car? Place front and back say chief of police. He has a bubble machine on top, a police radio. He even has a Winchester rifle hanging from brackets under his dashboard.
I've seen it. He uses that car to get through customs?
Yes.
Does he wear his uniform going through customs?
I don't know. I've never been with him. With that car, he doesn't need a uniform.
Does he take his wife to Mexico with him?
I know he has, and his teenage daughter.
How do you know he has?
I've seen them leaving town when I've known where they were going.
Okay, Gummy. Now tell me how you get the drugs.
Every week or 10 days they arrest me. They pull me down to the station house for questioning.
Who picks you up?
Town police, two of them if I'm alone on the street. If I'm with you guys, I mean the guys on the beach, they send more. Like Sunday. There were 7 of them, all dressed for a riot. They always expect somebody to jump on them, like you did Sunday. By the way, Fletch, why did you do that Sunday?
I wanted to get arrested. I wanted to go to the station house with you and see precisely what happened.
They really cracked your head. It sounded like a gunshot.
It did to me, too. Is Chief Cummings always with the cops who pick you up?
No, but they always say the chief wants me for questioning. They're a stupid bunch of cops.
What happens when you get to the station house?
I wait in the chief's office. He comes in and closes the door. He pretends to question me. I give him the money, he gives me the drugs. As simple as that. Sometimes they keep me in a jail cell overnight. It looks better.
How does the chief know that it's time to pick you up, that you're carrying money for him?
I park the minibus so he can see it from his office window.
How much money do you turn over to him on the average?
It averages about $20,000.
Every 2 or 3 weeks?
Every 10 days or so.
How do you transfer the money?
You said Fat Sam's already told you.
I want to hear it from you.
In a money belt, under my Hawaiian shirt.
And that's how you bring the drugs to Fat Sam?
Yeah, I carry the drugs in the money belt under the Hawaiian shirt.
How do you actually give it to Fat Sam?
I don't. I just walk to the back of the lean-to and drop it. He knows where to pick it up. Then I line up like everyone else and make a phony cash buy.
I've seen that. You really fooled me. So what do you get out of this?
Free drugs. Like the man said, all I can eat.
No cash?
No cash, never.
How did you pay for the minibus?
That belongs to Fat Sam. You should know that. Didn't he tell you that?
No, he didn't. I've never seen him use it.
He never leaves the beach.
Why does he never leave the beach?
He's afraid someone would try to rip him off. Everyone thinks he's carrying. Either drugs or money. He's not, of course. I am.
How does he give you the money?
In the money belt. I pretend to buy drugs every few days. When I see the money belt rolled up at the back of the lean-to, I sit down and put it on under my shirt.
Okay, Gummy, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
When Chief Cummings takes the money and gives you the drugs, are you always in the room alone with him?
Yes, with the door shut.
Has there ever been another police officer or anyone else with you at the transfer of the drugs and money?
No, never. Do you think any of the other police officers know that the chief is the source of the drugs at the beach?
They're dumb bunnies. None of them know. None of them have ever figured it out.
Aren't they suspicious that you and only you are brought in for questioning every week or 10 days?
My dad's superintendent of schools. They think Cummings has a particular concern for me. I also think they think I'm informing. I suspect some of them even think I'm working for the chief as a spy.
How long has this routine been going on?
How many years?
Yeah, how many years?
About 4 years.
How old are you, Gummy?
17.
So you couldn't have been using the minibus as a signal to the chief originally. What were you using?
My bicycle. I'd chain it to a parking meter. He'd be able to see it through his office window. My bike had a purple banana seat and a high rearview mirror.
How'd you get started being the go-between?
I got hooked my first year in high school. The runner was a senior named Jeff. He blew his brains out with a shotgun. I didn't know he'd been the runner until next time I went to Fat Sam.
Was it Fat Sam who got you going?
No, the day after I was turned off, I was pretty uptight. You know, pretty nervous. It was all beginning to hang out. In fact, I don't think I'd really known I was hooked until that day, until Jeff killed himself and the supply turned off. A couple of cops met me at the bicycle rack at the school. They picked me up and brought me to the station. I was scared shitless. The chief closed the door to his office, and we had our first talk. We made our first deal.
It was the chief who first got you going?
Yes.
Was it Fat Sam who gave you your first drugs?
No, it was Jeff at the high school. He got his free. He had extra. He gave it to me. I guess seeing I was the son of the superintendent, they figured getting me hooked would give them some extra protection, at least regarding the drugs in the school. After a few months, Jeff stopped giving it to me free and sent me to Fat Sam. He said I wanted too much. For a while, until Jeff blew his brains out, I had to pay for it.
How did you pay for it?
I burglarized my parents' house 3 times.
Your own house?
Yeah, I was afraid to burglarize anyone else's. I was just a little kid. I really hated stealing the color television.
Did your parents ever suspect you?
No, they would just report the burglary to Chief Cummings, buy new stuff with the insurance money.
Do your parents know you're a drug addict?
Yes, I guess so.
Have they never talked to you about it?
No, Dad doesn't want to make an issue out of it. After all, he's superintendent of schools.
Okay, Gummy. Just sit there and let me type a minute. Pletch typed almost a whole page, single-spaced. He had Gummy sign the 3 copies. Lewis Montgomery. He had the handwriting of a 9-year-old boy. Pletch witnessed the signature on each copy.
Is Bobby really dead?
Pletch said, yes.
She OD'd?
Yes.
Shit, I'm sorry.
So am I.
It's time this whole scene broke up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been wondering how it would stop. Jeff blew his brains out.
I know.
I do feel badly about Bobby.
I know. Pletch put the 3rd copy of the deposition folded into his back pocket. He put the typewriter back into its case. Gummy said,
"What will happen to me now?"
"Tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, I want you to be waiting at the beer stand. Fat Sam will be waiting there with you. You'll be picked up, probably by plainclothesmen. Until tomorrow at 11 o'clock, I want you to shut up."
"Okay, then what'll happen? What will the fuzz do to me?"
"They'll probably bring you to a hospital and check you in under another name."
"I've got to come down, huh?"
"You want to, don't you?"
"Yes, I think so."
Pletch did not understand why Gummy did not leave. The boy remained sitting on the floor, his back against the wall, his face toward the window. It was a moment before Fletch realized Gummy was crying. Fletch walked into the lean-to carrying the typewriter. Fat Sam was lying on his back on a bedroll on the sand, reading Mercuse's Eros and Civilization. The bedroll stank. Fat Sam stank.
"Hello, Vatsyayana."
In the back corner of the lean-to was a pile of empty soup cans. They stank. Fletch handed Vatsyayana Gummy's deposition. "I am Fletcher of the News Tribune." Fat Sam put the book face down on the sand. While Fat Sam read the deposition, Fletch sat cross-legged on the sand and opened the portable typewriter case. Again, he put an original and 2 carbons in the carriage.
Fat Sam read the deposition twice. Then he sat up. His look remained kind.
So, your turn. You even have the name spelled right. Charles Witherspoon. It's been a long time since I've heard it. I guess Gummy got it from the registration of the Volkswagen. Oh, yes. Vatsyayana looked out at the sunlit beach. You expect a deposition from me. I want to get Cummings. I don't blame you, a most unsavory man. Either you hang him or you'll hang with him. Oh, I'll hang him, all right. With pleasure.
Fat Sam reached for a book, Jonathan Eisen's The Age of Rock. In the back of the book was a folded piece of paper. Fat Sam blew the sand off it and handed it to Fletch. It read, Sam, Jeff killed himself tonight. The boys investigating report of a gunshot found him on the football field. We need a new runner. Maybe the Montgomery kid. He may show up in the next day or two with the money belt. We need someone local. Cummings.
Is that hard evidence or not?
That's hard evidence.
Note, if you will, my dear Fletch, the gentleman wrote and signed it in his own hand.
I do so note. How did you get it?
Would you believe it was delivered to me in a sealed envelope by an officer of the law? I've never known what to do with it. When there isn't the police, who is there? I forgot about the power of the press.
You have wanted to turn Cummings in?
Always. I have been his prisoner, you see, just as surely as if I were sitting in the town lockup.
I don't see.
When I first came here from Colorado, I had a supply of drugs, thanks to my dear old mother's insurance. To support myself here on this magnificent beach, I sold some of it off. The eminent chief of police had me arrested. He had the evidence. I either went to jail for a very long time or worked for him. I chose not to go to jail.
You mean you've never made a profit from this business?
No, never. I have been a prisoner.
Fat Sam, you're smarter than that. You're an intelligent man. You've known you could go over the head of the local police and turn Cummings in.
You do realize, Fletch, that I am an addict, too.
Yes.
I became addicted while teaching music in the Denver public school system. I was already at the end of my rope when my mother died, fortuitously leaving me $15,000 in life insurance.
You could have stopped the whole thing here any time, especially once you had this note.
I realize that. The chief has continuously had evidence against me. Current evidence. Two, I am an addict. My profit from my partnership with the eminent chief of police has been free drugs all these years, just like Gummy. The chief pays off only in merchandise. Three, I have always hoped for a guarantee of some sort if I am to turn state's evidence. Do you have such a guarantee, Fletch?
Yes. I'll have you picked up at the beer stand tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, you and Gummy.
How very considerate of you. And then I presume you will splash this sordid affair all over your newspaper.
The whole story will be in tomorrow afternoon's News Tribune. The first afternoon edition appears at 11:20 in the morning. If you are not at the beer stand at 11, you will probably be dead by 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, I'll be there. In fact, I would say you're pulling it rather close.
I don't want to tip my hand until the morning.
I see. And will you need photographs?
I have them already.
Several fine shots of you dealing. In fact, I had them developed and made yesterday at the office. They're awaiting captions.
How very efficient.
I remember once saying you weren't very bright. I think you are a very good actor.
I'm a liar with a fantastic memory.
That's what an actor is. How did you catch on?
I watched the drop 3 times before I realized it was Gummy. It was his Hawaiian shirt. It was his being picked up by the police regularly. He was the only one ever picked up by the police. And he was picked up only when your supply was running low. Actually, I think it was Creasy who mentioned the repetitious coincidence of timing. He didn't realize what he was saying. Then Sunday night, when I tried to get arrested with Gummy and I belted 3 cops and they didn't arrest me, I knew Cummings did not want anyone with Gummy at the station. They wanted him alone.
Of course.
Then someone else mentioned the chief's frequent trips to Mexico. I heard that the first time last Saturday noon from a very unlikely source.
Who?
A man named John Collins.
I don't know him.
You don't play tennis?
I used to, back when I was alive. How did you get the deposition out of Gummy?
I told him you'd already signed one, naming him as Pusher.
Oh, that was dirty pool. And why would Gummy believe that I had signed a deposition?
Because Bobby is dead, Fat Sam. She really is dead.
I see. I'm sorry. She was a pretty child. Where is her body?
It's about to be found.
And her body being found will trigger a whole chain of events. Super cops will flood the beach.
You wouldn't have a chance. Fat Sam lit a joint and inhaled deeply. He handed it to Fletch.
Peace.
Fuck.
That too.
Fletch inhaled twice.
It's time, Fat Sam said. It's time.
Gummy said the same thing.
I wonder if I have any life left. I'm 38 and feel 100.
You'll get help.
Now I wish they would put me in jail for a long time.
Fat Sam inhaled again.
I suppose I don't really. I'm smoking a joint. I shot up 2 hours ago. Oh, Buddha.
It's time to do the deposition.
No, son, move away from the typewriter. I'll do it myself.
Fletch lay down on the sand with the rest of the joint. Fat Sam sat at the typewriter.
Now let's see if Vatsyayana remembers how to type. Let's see if Fat Sam remembers how to type. Let's see if Charles Witherspoon remembers how to type.
To Fletch, stoned on the sand, the typing seemed very slow. Chapter 27.
It is Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Although I have what can be termed fresh intuitive evidence, I cannot pretend that I have much fresh factual evidence. My best guess at the moment, based on no factual evidence, is that Alan Stanwyck is absolutely straight, that what he says is the truth. He is dying of cancer. He wishes me to murder him tomorrow night at 8:30.
Fletch had returned to his apartment, taken a shower, eaten a sandwich, and poured a quart of milk down his throat. On the coffee table before him were the two depositions and their copies, and the original of Cummings's incriminating note to Fat Sam. There was also the big tape recorder. Yesterday morning, Alan Stanwyck picked me up in his car again and confirmed my intention to murder him. We reviewed the murder plan. Conversationally, he asked me the flight number of the Transworld Airlines plane for Buenos Aires. I denied knowing the flight number, as he himself had not mentioned it to me. In fact, I did know the flight number, as I had confirmed the reservation with the airline. My apparent failure to know the flight number should have meant two things to him. First, he should continue seeing me in character as a drifter. That is, I'm apparently as stupid and trusting as he thinks I am. Second, he should be satisfied that if he is being investigated, I am not the source of the investigation. Conversationally, without appearing out of character, I was able to ask him one of my major questions. Why, if he wishes to commit suicide, doesn't he crash in an airplane, as everybody half expects? His answer was one of pride, that after years of keeping airplanes in the air, he couldn't aim one for the ground. This is an acceptable answer. As he pointed out, people do spend more than $50,000 in support of pride. Any man who lives in a house worth more than $1 million can be expected to spend $50,000 on a matter such as this, which would so profoundly affect his most personal pride. Alan Stanwyck has a mistress, a Mrs. Sandra Faulkner, of 15641B Putnam Street. He spends Monday and Wednesday evenings with her. Mrs. Faulkner is a widow who used to work at Collins Aviation. Stanwyck and Mrs. Faulkner did not particularly know each other while Mrs. Faulkner worked at Collins Aviation. Sandra Faulkner's husband was a test pilot who was killed while attempting to land on an aircraft carrier, leaving her childless. At the time of the death, Sandra Faulkner left her employment at Collins Aviation, ran through her insurance money and whatever other sums she had available, and in the process became a drunk. It was approximately a year after the death that Alan Stanwyck discovered the straits she was in and came to her with what can only be described as a genuine instinct of mercy. Being a test pilot himself, it can be properly assumed his sympathy for the widow of a test pilot was entirely sincere. He paid for her hospitalization and has been supporting her ever since. I would estimate this affair has been going on about 2 years. Sandra Faulkner does not deny that she and Stanwyck have a sexual relationship. Joan Collins Stanwyck is unaware of the fact of this relationship, as she is quick to refer to her husband's working late at the office on Mondays and Wednesdays. However, I have subjective knowledge that Joan Collins Stanwyck herself is unfaithful to her husband. Returning to Sandra Faulkner, Stanwyck's mistress is unaware that Stanwyck is terminally ill, if he is. She is unaware of any change in the relationship in the foreseeable future, such as the possibility of sudden death. Her apartment and other belongings show no sign of being packed up. She is of the opinion that Stanwyck's health is excellent, and that their relationship will continue unchanged in the foreseeable future. Otherwise, I would characterize the relationship of Stanwyck and his mistress as generous on his part, even noble. Here is a woman of no great attraction, a heavy drinking and emotional problem, who desperately needs a friend. Stanwyck, really from a great distance, perceives that problem and becomes the friend she needs. He has no real reason to exercise such a sensitivity toward the widow of a man he never knew, or toward an unknown and unimportant ex-employee of Collins Aviation. Yet he does. This is the most consistently surprising element in Alan Stanwyck's character. The man has a peculiar principle and a unique sense of profound loyalty. Evidence of this rare personality trait can be found in his extraordinary, frequent, and reasonably secret trips to his hometown, Nonhegan, Pennsylvania, where his mother and father still live. In his refusing to join a fraternity at Colgate until the fraternity had made his roommate, Bert Eberhardt, equally welcome. His subsequent loyalty to this same ex-roommate, Eberhardt, in virtually setting him up in a business, supporting him royally as his personal and corporate insurance man, when the two men really have nothing in common at this point, if they ever did have. In his relationship with a mistress, from which the mistress has benefited far more than he, and not just in worldly goods, but in mental, emotional, and physical health. Despite Stanwyck's obvious personal ambitions, which may be evidenced by his marrying the boss's daughter, which remains possible as a result of genuine love, as Amelia Shercliffe pointed out, one really must conclude that Alan Stanwyck is a remarkably decent and honest man. What he says is true. Nevertheless, I am professionally obliged to retain my skepticism to the ultimate moment. It is entirely possible I have not assembled the right facts, or noticed them, or put them in the right order. It is possible I have not asked the right questions. I must continue to believe that Stanwyck's basic statement that he is dying of cancer is not true until I have proved it true. So far, I have not proved this basic statement true. Pletch turned off the tape recorder and stood for a moment in front of the divan, studying the d'Hysterie. Four photographs of a dreadfully unattractive woman in 19th-century bathing costume. In it were so many truths. The truth of momentary fashion, the truth of what the woman thought of herself, the truth of the experience of being photographed, the hard truth of the camera. Fletch put down the microphone and rewound the Alan Stanwyck tape. Wandering around the room, he listened to the tape, his own voice droning on, at first against a background of traffic noise, then in the silence of this same room, remembering that at first, less than a week ago, he wasn't sure who Alan Stanwyck was. The voice continued, not always succeeding in separating fact from speculation, observation from intuition, but nevertheless cutting through to a reasonable sketch of a man, his life and affairs, Alan Stanwyck. Fletch played the tape again, going over the 6 days in his mind, trying to remember the smaller observations and impressions he had failed to record on the tape. Clearly irrelevant matters. Joan Stanwyck was visibly lonely and drinking martinis before lunch on the Saturday her husband was flying an experimental airplane in Idaho. Dr. Joseph Devlin had answered the phone too fast when he heard the call concerned Alan Stanwyck, and he did not appear to question that the call had come from the insurance company. Sandra Faulkner's apartment had been burglarized, apparently by a child. Bert Eberhardt thought Alan's daughter, Julie Stanwyck, a brat. Alan Stanwyck did not use the cigarette lighter on the dashboard of his car. He, Fletch, had not yet bought a pair of gloves. Fletch sat on the divan again and picked up the microphone. Alan Stanwyck is a decent man, a man of principle and profound loyalty, a strong man, an ambitious man. I do not understand his relationship with his parents. He didn't invite his parents to his wedding. He hasn't told them they have a 5 or 6-year-old granddaughter. Yet he visits them across country every 6 weeks. The answer has to be that his relationship is not with his parents, but with Nonhegan, Pennsylvania. Fletch turned off the tape recorder and went into the bedroom to use the phone. It was 4:30, Wednesday. Chapter 28.
Mr. Stanwyck, believe it or not, this is Sidney James of Casewell Insurers again.
I thought you'd call again. Once you long-distance dialers learn a telephone number, you're apt to ring it a lot.
I expect this will be the last time I bother you, sir.
That's all right, son. I hope it isn't. I bought some more telephone stock yesterday.
The hardware store must be doing pretty well.
It's doing all right. Ever since the price of labor went sky high, people have been rushing to the hardware store to buy the wrong equipment for jobs around the house they never intend to do anyway. You've heard of selling used equipment? I bet half the stuff I sell never gets used in the first place.
I thought you said the telephone company is the only business making money these days.
The hardware business is doing pretty good, too, although I'd only admit it long distance to California.
You seem to have things pretty well figured out, sir.
How are you figuring these days? You picking up that Bronze Star?
Yes, sir, I am.
That's good, son. That's fine. Can we keep it for you?
I noticed a space in the back of my sock drawer where I think it would fit.
I thought you'd make the right decision. There never was a country that didn't need to decorate people.
Thanks for the offer, anyway. How's Mrs. Stanwyck?
Oh, I forgot your pulse taker. When I was home for lunch, Mrs. Stanwyck was still ticking over nicely. The older models are the best, you know. Better built, and they use less fuel.
Say, Mr. Stanwyck, the last time we talked, you said your son Alan gave up boxing, refused to go to the Nationals after winning the state's Golden Gloves because of girls.
Yes, I did say that.
Is that what you meant?
Well, son, I believe a man of my age has sufficient motor memory to mean approximately the same thing when he says girls as a young buck of your age. If I remember rightly, girls have a couple of legs under them, a hank of hair up top, and a couple of protuberances about grab height. That about right?
That's about right, sir.
I thought so.
What I mean is, did you mean girls or girl?
I'm in the hardware business, son. I'm apt to speak in gross lots.
Did you mean any girl in particular? Was there any one particular girl who was the cause of Alan's giving up boxing?
There certainly was.
Who was she?
You insurance men ask some funny questions.
We'll be through with this case very soon, sir. We'll stop bothering you.
Mr. James, you sound more like a private investigator or something than an insurance man.
Going over this policy, Mr. Stanwyck, we noticed a small bequest we don't understand. We have to check out whether the person is a relative or not, whether or not she's still alive, the current address, etc.
I should think all that would be up to Alan, the insured.
Your son's a very busy man, Mr. Stanwyck. You'd be surprised how many people fail to maintain the proper information on policies of this sort.
I suppose I would.
They experience the death of a friend or get a postcard saying a friend's address has changed, and it never occurs to them to update such a thing in an insurance file.
I guess I understand. But if you hadn't won a Bronze Star, Mr. James, I think I'd be inclined to tell you to leap into the Pacific Ocean. Are you near the Pacific Ocean out there?
I can see it through my window, Mr. Stanwyck. Who's the girl?
Sally Ann Cushing. Or she's known now, Sally Ann Cushing Cavanaugh.
Alan and she were in love?
They were thicker than Elmer's glue. Sticky. For years there, you hardly saw one without seeing the other one attached. If they weren't kissing, they were holding hands. Here in town, we had to widen the sidewalks for them. You couldn't pry them apart.
Alan gave up boxing because of Sally Ann Cushing?